Welcome to episode 12 of Weekly Weights. Today we have a very special guest, Luke Tulloch.
So Luke is a colleague of Alex and myself here at Lift Performance Center. He has a degree in neuroscience. He's been in the industry for over a decade, which has culminated in him starting his own ongoing education company for personal trainers called Lucid Health Education. Is that correct?
Yep.
Lucid Health Education. He's also been recruited by another friend of ours, Dave Welch, to contribute some advanced physiology to an upcoming bodybuilding coaching certification, which is going to be done by Level Up Continuing Education. So Luke's one of the sort of highly esteemed peers in the field, I guess, that Alex and I have, especially in terms of advanced physiology.
So we talk a lot about long-term planning on this podcast. So today we're going to ask you about planning for nutrition. So first of all, what is nutritional periodization and what's the purpose of it?
So nutritional periodization basically is similar to what we do with training, right? So we're going to multiply and change our variables based on what we're trying to achieve with our training. Same as you might change like your rep ranges, your intensities, how much volume you're doing with your training. You can also change some stuff with your nutrition. So you can change macronutrients, you can change energy intakes, timing, anything that involves your nutrition you can change. Why would you want to do that? Well, it's got a lot to do with what your actual training goal is and what you're trying to achieve from your training. For powerlifting specifically, it obviously ties into like if you're trying to work within a certain weight class, for performance, what do you do when you're coming up to a meet? You can do this stuff on like a big time scale, or you could do it on a small time scale. So you could change things throughout the week like you might do with training. You could also, do it over a longer period of time. Like, let's say you're going to do a meet in like 16 weeks or something. You could change your nutrition throughout that time to try and maximize your weight, your performance, all that type of stuff. So there's like a fair bit to it. I think people don't really think about it too much. Like, we often think about training variables a lot, but we don't really think about nutrition variables so much in strength sports. So, yeah, it's basically it.
Okay, so, you go.
So what are the factors that we like to manipulate the most?
Usually I would say there's a hierarchy of what's most important and what's most impactful versus what, might give you an extra sort of, 5% or something like that. So whenever we talk about nutrition, I like to think about it in a hierarchy of your energy balance and your macronutrient ratios being like clearly the most important stuff that's going to give the most impact to whatever you're doing. And then after that, you can look at things that are a bit more related to like food quality and nutrient timing. And then like probably right at the tail end is even supplementation, which is like not that important, but can still make a difference. The main thing being that it depends what your actual goal is with your training. Even obviously powerlifting, it's like, oh yeah, we're trying to get stronger. Like no shit, but what we're trying to actually do is do that within the confines of a weight class and a certain level of experience too. So depending on the training age and experience of the athlete, how advanced they are, depending on what your weight class is and what you want to do with that, depending on your actual body composition and what you're currently doing, there's a lot you can kind of change, and it goes in this sort of hierarchy of importance. So certain things will always outweigh others in terms of what you can get out of them.
So if I were to sort of sum up what I'm hearing from you so far, it's that we can manipulate nutritional variables to maximize training performance and the adaptations we get to training.
Yep.
While still working within the confines of a weight class.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
So if we sort of step back and look from a like almost a more long-term athletic development standpoint, how much emphasis do you think we should be actually giving to body composition for strength sport athletes and why?
Well, I think body composition, basically we can look at it on two factors. One is just purely how much muscle you've built. The other one is sort of your ratio of lean mass to fat mass. So the idea is that obviously we want to maximize the amount of lean mass we have to fat mass. For some people, it's a little bit less important depending on your weight class and your level of experience. Like some people are just going to want to go into a meet, for example, and just do their best. They're not necessarily looking to min and max everything. But generally speaking, the more muscle mass you have, the more lean mass you have, the stronger you have greater potential, essentially. So the more muscle you have, the more you can, train that muscle to lift heavy weights.
So as a powerlifter, when do you think is the right time to start thinking about optimizing body composition?
Well, I think we should always be thinking about trying to increase muscle mass as much as we can, no matter what your level is. As you get to like elite level, you're probably going to be a little bit confined by weight classes, and then maybe you're not necessarily looking to put on stacks of muscle, but you're still looking to optimize the amount of muscle that you've got. I would say that as you get more experienced, it starts becoming more and more important what your body composition is. Obviously, because you're starting to put on more muscle mass and fill out whatever weight class you're settling into. Earlier on in your training career, you're obviously just looking to get some experience, actually practice the lifts, enjoy the training. And then as you get more advanced, you're starting to try and maximize whatever adaptations you're getting out of the training. And so then you want to minimize body fat up to a point. Like if you get super, super lean, this is probably something we'll talk about in terms of how you periodize stuff, but it will actually change your leverages to some extent, and it will change how lifting the weights feels. So there is probably a sweet spot for people, and that's just going to depend on their own experience and their own leverages and all that type of stuff. But generally speaking, the leaner you can be, it means that you're able to go in the lightest possible weight class with the most amount of muscle.
Yeah, so I think this is something we've spoken about a number of times on the show, and it's a very obvious observation to make that when you look at the absolutely elite powerlifters across pretty much every weight class until the super heavies, it's people who are, you know, comparatively short but very muscular and lean who are lifting the most weight, because they've got that combination of a huge amount of strength producing potential in their muscles, but they're not carrying much body fat, and they're putting that on a frame that's quite small. So there's something to be said as well for not just being lean, but for being sort of as big as your frame can carry and being lean as well.
Yeah, totally. I 100% agree with that.
Right. And so I guess across the course of a career, although you might be trying to put on muscle mass constantly, you again need to consider keeping your body composition good or staying lean, I guess, for long enough to end up actually filling out a weight class with muscle as opposed to just filling out a weight class with weight.
Yeah, totally. And honestly, like, this is funny because it sounds a lot like bodybuilding. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't think powerlifting and bodybuilding are too dissimilar, to be perfectly honest. I think the main difference is just the skill aspect of actually peaking for a meet with the lifts. That's pretty much it. There's maybe a bit more variety in the movements used for bodybuilding and stuff, but really the strategy is the same. It's like you want to pretty much be as lean as you can get on competition day without being too heavy for whatever weight class you're in.
Yeah, exactly. All right, quick shout out to Ali Martin, our Lift Performance Center colleague, who always likes to start vacuuming outside the room when we're recording.
She definitely won't be listening.
No, she probably won't be listening, but I love you, Ali. If this filters back to her, just stop fucking vacuuming. So you're actually making a really interesting point, which is that powerlifting and bodybuilding are in some respects very similar.
Mm.
And again, I think that's something that Alex and I have touched on in a number of podcasts when we were talking about the early developmental stages of athletes being focused on actually building a muscular base, building good technique, yeah, and, you know, actually getting that strength potential there and setting yourself up with the, I guess, integrity to train hard longer term. But what I think would be a really good thing for us to do today is actually speak in the phases that we consider in normal powerlifting prep, so hypertrophy, strength, and peaking phases,
mm-hmm,
and maybe discuss the nutritional requirements of each and ways in which we can sort of work to synergize nutrition and training. So let's start with hypertrophy phases. What are the main nutritional considerations that we would consider to maximize training and adaptation?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. So you want to, obviously, you're trying to maximize how much muscle you can build. For me, protein is pretty much going to, no matter what you're doing, is going to stay roughly where it is. So we always want to have an adequate amount of protein. And, you know, there's obviously ranges that you can use in terms of how much you weigh and how much protein you can eat. So, like, usually the lowest I go is probably, like, you can even go as low as 1.4 grams per kilo of body weight for working out how much protein you should be eating every day. But generally speaking, I like to push it up closer to about 2 grams per kilo of body weight if you're engaging in resistance training, which is obviously what we're going to be doing. So that's not going to move. So that's the first thing.
And then, you're saying phase by phase protein intakes are about the same?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
And then from there, it's kind of like, well, we need to work out how much energy we need. And then how are we going to fill out that energy? Are we going to use more fat or are we going to use more carbohydrates? In a hypertrophy block, what you're trying to do is you're trying to provide enough energy to signal to the body that, yes, we can go ahead and release the brakes on building muscle. So there's a lot of things that go into building muscle. You have some nutritional elements and you have some non-nutritional elements, some more training elements. when we look at molecularly what happens when we try and build muscle, there's a bunch of signals that come from training that could be due to like metabolic stress, can be due to the mechanical tension you put on the fibers. But then on the nutrition side, there's a few interesting things too. There's how much energy there is available. There's how much glycogen you have available, which is the stored carbohydrate in your muscle, things of that nature. So when we're trying to maximize muscle growth, we want to have enough energy. So at the very least, you want to be meeting your caloric needs every day, if not going over a little bit, so that you've got a surplus of energy to build that muscle. And then you also want to have enough protein, obviously, because those are the, that's the building block of muscle. And then you want to have enough carbohydrate availability too, because it's actually quite interesting that your levels of stored glucose, glycogen in your muscle is actually something that influences the protein synthesis that happens during muscle building. So when you're setting out this for trying to maximize your muscle gain, it's like, okay, we want to probably prioritize having enough protein, having enough energy overall, and then having enough carbohydrate floating around.
Yeah.
So then the argument is, well, how much carbohydrate do we need, right? So when we're trying to fuel our training, it's if you look at the research and the literature out there, like all the research we have is mostly centered on endurance training. And so you'll see people being like, oh, well, for optimal athletic performance, you need like 600 grams of carbs a day, which is like nowhere near the case for people engaged in weight training and especially like more strength training. It's just not even close, man. So in terms of optimally fueling, like getting enough carbohydrate in to fuel your training for powerlifting or bodybuilding, it's probably less carbohydrate than people think it is. But it's also a case of like, you need to have enough. Like, I wouldn't be going super low carb or anything like that in that case.
So you spoke about energy requirements during a hypertrophy phase. Let's put a number on it.
Yep.
So if we want to be in a surplus, how big of a surplus should we be in?
Well, so the goal here is obviously that you don't want to get to a place where you're like just fat. And then I was like, oh shit, I got really fat. Now I got to cut all this weight so that I'm not fat for my meat. So you got to be careful.
What would be like a reasonable caloric surplus in terms of like extra calories or percentage?
Or maybe a rate of weight gain.
Yeah, so I usually go like, generally speaking, I go with a small surplus, but it's got to be enough that you can guarantee it's a surplus. Like, there's a natural variation in how much you eat every day, and even if you're weighing and measuring your food, like, there's going to be a natural variation in that, and there needs to be, like, a strong enough signal to the body that, like, yeah, we're in a surplus. So it needs to be, like, a minimum of 5%, but I'd say you could go up to 10% surplus if you wanted to. So probably, like a couple hundred calories for most people. And then in terms of rate of weight gain, try and keep it pretty minimal. So like I would say maybe if you take your body weight in kilos and then you take 0.5% of your body weight, I would probably keep it at that as a probably a maximum over like a few weeks or a couple of months. Just because if you're gaining faster than that, then there's a decent chance that a lot of that's going to be fat. Like you just can't build muscle that quickly. And then it's just going to be a case of you having to take the same amount of time to diet that fat off again if you need to cut that fat for a weight class.
So if you were doing, let's say, an 8-week hypertrophy block, how much muscle and how much weight would you be expecting to gain in that 8 weeks?
Yeah, the muscle's not going to be like a heap, but you're going to have to accept that you'll probably put some fat on as well. So in terms of weight, your weight may go up by like, you know, on average 250 grams to half a kilo a week or something like that, and you know that probably not all of that is going to be muscle, and that's just how it is. It's really difficult to build muscle without gaining any fat whatsoever, so that's probably what you're looking at.
All right, you were saying that carbohydrate requirements aren't exceptionally high for strength athletes, but you were saying also that it's important or it's beneficial to have relatively full glycogen stores. At what point do you think it's disadvantageous to sort of maximize carbohydrate intake within your energy window? And what benefits or drawbacks are there to having very high carb intakes when bulking?
Yeah, so like this is quite an interesting one because it's not just a case of like, well, I use this amount of glycogen when I train and therefore I only need to use this amount of carbohydrate to replenish that glycogen that I've burned off every time I train. Because we know that things like your actual exercise performance is somewhat dependent on how much blood glucose you have and just sort of the perception of having enough carbohydrate there. So it's pretty interesting. Like, you could, part of fatigue is like what we call, maybe substrate level fatigue, where like you've literally just run out of stuff to burn to when you're lifting weights. And that's like not going to happen. It's really difficult to do that. You don't burn that much glycogen when you lift weights. That might happen at the end of like a hard marathon, for example. But it's not going to happen when we're lifting weights. So then it's like, okay, there's substrate level fatigue, but there's also more of a sort of central fatigue model, which comes from essentially your brain going like, hey, I'm really tired, I want to stop lifting now. And you basically give up, right? And so it's fatigue that's coming from your nervous system going like, this is really hard, I don't want to do it anymore. And that's usually what the type of fatigue we feel when we're doing our weight training. So in this case, having some carbohydrate availability actually changes our perception of that fatigue. And so you can even have situations where you get people to rinse their mouth out with a carbohydrate solution and they get a reduced perception of fatigue when they're doing like time trials and stuff. So yeah, okay, that's not weightlifting, but there's definitely something to that. So having enough carbohydrate in there can affect, how you feel when you're training, which could get you a better result. So it's not just like, well, I need to replenish whatever I'm burning during training. It's also, I need to have enough there so that I have a good session and I feel good when I'm training. So in that case, that's going to vary a little bit for people. If you go like maximal carbohydrate and you sort of punish yourself and put in as much as you can, especially if you're in a surplus, you could be inducing some insulin resistance to an extent. And just to explain insulin resistance, if people don't really know, it's basically how sensitive your muscle is to soaking up and using that glucose. So if you are presenting it with heaps and heaps and heaps of glucose all the time, eventually it kind of just becomes deaf to that glucose and it doesn't really take it up and use it as well anymore. So you don't want to do that, right? But on the other hand, you still want to have enough carbohydrate around to make it feel like you can train really hard. So it's sort of a little weird dichotomy there.
So you made a couple of points there about fueling training and sort of the immediate fatigue-reducing benefits of eating carbohydrate, and then also about replenishment, which leads us logically to talking about how we would distribute carbohydrate intake to facilitate hypertrophy training.
Yep.
So are there any particular guidelines you follow, and when should you eat carbs?
Yeah, pretty much just eat them whenever. But the idea is that if you want to maximize it, I would have some carbohydrate and some protein in your bloodstream, like when you're training. And then I would have some again pretty soon after your training, just to maximize the anabolic response from your muscles. And the idea there is like pretty simple. I use a really basic formula. If you take, we'll take body weight in kilos. If you take half your body weight in kilos, you can eat that amount in grams of both protein and carbs roughly as like a pre-workout meal whenever you're comfortable before the session. So some people can eat like half an hour before a session, they feel totally cool. I'm not one of those people. So generally speaking, I say like within an hour or two before your training session, 0.5 grams per kilo of body weight in carbs, 0.5 grams per kilo of body weight in protein. That's a pretty solid pre-workout meal. It can take whatever form you want, whether it's liquid or solid, whatever. And then I tend to do the same thing within an hour after training as well. So a lot of people get really hung up about having this like immediate proximity to training with timing stuff. And honestly, especially if you're eating a solid meal, we're almost never in what we call a post-absorptive state, meaning we've completely absorbed all the nutrients from our gut, distributed them to all of our tissues, and we're no longer getting any benefit from them. We're usually in what we call a post-prandial state, which means we're still sort of absorbing and utilizing those nutrients. So our meals throughout the day pretty much always overlap. And most of the time, the only time that you're in a post-absorptive state is like when you wake up in the morning and you haven't eaten because you've been sleeping. So as long as you sort of sandwich the workout with some nutrients, you'll be totally cool.
Okay, cool. I just want to touch on something that I think we've alluded to, but not entirely explored, which is why it is that high energy and carbohydrate intakes are important in hypertrophy training. So for us as powerlifters, and presumably for yourself with more bodybuilding training, hypertrophy training phases are the ones with the highest volumes,
yep.
And not just on a set-by-set basis, but also on a day-by-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about carbohydrate and energy intake that's important for keeping you going and progressing in those phases?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. Again, it's like the having enough substrate around to do the work, essentially, just having enough fuel there. The other thing is that we have this powerful signaling from things like insulin that support the anabolic response, so protein synthesis. The other thing is that we have a like the preferential fuel for the nervous system is actually glucose as well. So I think that plays a pretty big role in like that perception of fatigue that I mentioned before. So I just want to touch on this, is that you also have this sort of weird situation where I'll give a bit of a case study. Let's say you've got a meet that's coming up in like, I don't know, let's say 4 months, and you have the option of you need to cut some weight for that meet. When do you do the cut? Do you do the cut closer to the meet, or do you do the cut earlier on? I actually think that, so a lot of people would say, well, okay, you're doing hypertrophy training, you've got greater volume, you got higher glycolytic demands. In other words, you're doing higher rep ranges. That's a little bit more dependent on carbohydrate metabolism. You should position more of your carbs there. But what I've actually found over time is that often what a better way of doing things is, if you're going to go into a deficit so you can lose fat, you might actually want to do that during your hypertrophy phase, which is going to be further out from the meet. Why would you do that? Well, we spoke a little bit before about how there are different signals that cause the muscle to grow. Some of them are nutrition, some of them are training. The strongest stimulus for growing muscle and keeping muscle is the training, okay? So you want to have the training, the hypertrophy training, around that time when you're actually in a caloric deficit. So on one hand, you're going to have the nutrition signals to the muscle actually telling it to stop growing and maybe lose muscle, but you've also got the most potent training stimulus at the same time telling us to keep muscle. And that's basically what bodybuilders do when they come into a show. They try and keep their training the same while cutting their nutrition down, and usually they won't lose any muscle. So there's this like, you know, this sort of, I suppose, counterintuitive for some people, where you might set it up and go, well, I want to grow as much muscle as possible. I want to fuel all the training volume I'm going to do in my hypertrophy phase. So therefore, I need to put all my energy and all my carbohydrate during that phase. But on the other hand, if you need to lose weight and you need to be in a deficit, that's actually the best phase to do it in, because you're going to retain as much muscle as possible in that phase.
So obviously in powerlifting, being in a calorie deficit is never a benefit. But if you're going to do it at all, you recommend doing it when our volume is the highest.
Yeah, for sure. Just because you'll hang on to as much muscle as possible. Like the alternative is, okay, if we spend all of our calories, we're in a surplus, we have most of our carbohydrate and everything during that hypertrophy phase when we're, you know, like 12 weeks away from a meet, like sure, okay, you might grow a little bit of muscle, but when it comes down to having to cut weight later on, that's when you're at risk of actually losing muscle. And also you're closer to the meet, which means you're making changes to your body shape, making changes to your body size close to a meet, which is probably not ideal if you're trying to improve the skill of actually lifting heavy.
Okay, so I relish the chance to disagree with our guests. In this instance, I actually agree with you in practice, but I disagree with you a little bit in theory, and I just want to throw some ideas to you and hear your response.
Mm-hmm.
So we have reasonable support in the literature that you can retain muscle on reduced training volumes, provided that tension, or like we say intensity, and in this instance we mean relative intensity, so if you're doing sets of eight, your sets of eight need to stay roughly as heavy, but provided the tension stimulus is there, we can sustain muscle on reduced volumes. So in my mind, I've always thought the most advantageous time to cut for powerlifting is during a strength phase, because the actual, like you were saying, the glycolytic demands of training are reduced, so we can sustain a higher training performance. We have adequate tension to maintain, maintain the muscle that's on our frame. And we're not sort of, I say this in inverted commas, wasting a hypertrophy phase where we could be building muscle. And so for me, when I see somebody who says I need to lose, you know, 5 or 8 kilos of tissue weight before I prepare for a competition, I'd be more inclined to reduce the length of their hypertrophy phase and give them a longer strength phase, or sort of like, you know, strength maintenance phase, I suppose, during which time I would make those manipulations, rather than spend time during doing training that may not yield immediate powerlifting performance improvements, just to maximize muscle retention, because I don't necessarily think we need as much of a training stimulus. I don't know, to what degree do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I think that's all fair enough. That's totally fair enough. I think it probably depends on a few things. One being how much you have to lose, and also your training age. Like if you've got a lot of body fat to lose and you're a relatively new lifter, I honestly don't think it's going to make much difference either way. I think you can kind of just do it and lose the body fat. if you're a more advanced lifter, you're going to be much more sensitive to those changes. It might be a little easier for you to keep muscle, but it's also going to be a case of, you know, you're walking a much finer line there. So I think you're probably right. The priority should always be to maximize the amount of muscle mass you have. If you already have a ton of muscle mass, it's like doing a hypertrophy phase, you're not really going to gain a lot. Like, I don't think people understand how difficult it can be when you're advanced to build muscle. Like, as someone who's a natural bodybuilder now, I kind of do it as a hobby. I don't compete, but I basically am pretty happy if I can put on maybe like half a kilo of lean tissue in a year of training at this point. So half a kilo to a kilo of lean tissue would be fantastic for me. You know, so like if we're talking like a 12-week phase where you're trying to put on like a significant amount of muscle in like fucking 4 or 8 weeks, like that's not going to happen. So your priority needs to be like reduce the body fat as much as you can, because that's way easier to manipulate. But I think your idea is totally cool. And like, I do agree, you actually don't need that much volume to maintain muscle mass. I agree with that. So maybe it's more appropriate to do that in a strength phase. But certainly I think having as much time as you can to adjust to whatever body fat range you're in is really important, because your leverages will change, so things will feel very different as you lose weight or gain weight. And it's really important in a strength sport where you have sort of skill and leverages play a really big advantage, a big part, then it's really important that you get used to that and you spend enough time training at that level.
Having done numerous cuts way too late,
I can
speak on leverages changing in a strength block, making it very, very hard.
Yes.
To, especially in the squat for me, find my groove.
Yep.
And I think as I'm actually working with a nutrition coach now, and I've done my cutting along like a further way out where my volume's been a little bit higher, and my leverages and my rhythm has been a lot better close to the competition as I've sort of maintained the same leverages.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I think Alex and I have made this point as well, maybe 3 or 4 podcasts running, is that the closer to a meet you get, the more important it is for your fatigue state to be correct when you're training. Like, you can't sustain peaking training or even hard strength phase training under like really, really high levels of fatigue properly. And so when you're cutting, that's basically just throwing in another stressor, or it's taking away one of your biggest tools for fatigue reduction.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, in this respect, I think we both agree with Luke. It's really important to do your big body composition manipulations far from the meat wherever you can. Is that fair?
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. I think we're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back and we'll talk about strength phases and peaking phases and what we do nutritionally.
Weekly Weights. Welcome back to Weekly Weights. Will and I are here with Luke Tulloch. We've just spoken about the nutritional requirements in a hypertrophy block. So we're going to move on to our next phase of training, which would be a strength block. So Luke, what are the main nutritional requirements of a strength block?
Essentially, in a strength block, the biggest thing we're trying to do is, at the very least, maintain our lean mass. And then we're obviously trying to support the training and make sure that recovery is as optimal as it can be so that we can obviously get the most out of our training. You know, so it gets a little more straightforward in this phase, I think, because it's literally a case of get enough protein, have a minimal level of fat so that you don't feel like total shit, and then the rest of your calories will, in my preference, is to mostly come from carbohydrate. And again, the carbohydrate being there because it helps top off glycogen stores, it helps fuel the nervous system, it helps perception of fatigue during training. And you don't need a ton of carbohydrate, like, you know, like maybe you would have in a hypertrophy phase or as an endurance athlete, but still adequate carbohydrate there just so that you feel pretty good. Like, there's some personal preference with how much fat and carb you have, but in my opinion, past a certain point, which is quite a low point, fat doesn't really offer much physiological benefit, you know? So I would prefer that we're having the carbohydrate, and if it's like more carbohydrate than we really need, that's fine. It's like, it's not really a big deal, but we know for sure that like if you're getting like 150 grams of fat a day, you're not really getting much out of that fat other than just energy at that point.
So speaking on energy, what would you recommend as far as calorie intake goes during a strength block? Would you say maintenance?
Yeah, probably try and stay around maintenance. Like if you're a little bit over, then that's fine. It's probably preferable to be over than it is to be under, to be honest. But it totally, again, like we said, you may be in a situation where you're having a longer sort of strength block rather than, you know, equal like hypertrophy and strength blocks and then a peaking phase afterwards. You might just have a much longer sort of strength block, and in that case, you know, you might be cutting a little bit of weight at that point, which could happen. Just depends on your timeline and how much weight you have to lose, that type of thing. So in that case, obviously, you'd be in a bit more of a deficit. But I'd try and stay away from being in a deficit as much as I could, just because, as we said before, one of the biggest things that impacts your recovery and your level of fatigue is how much energy you have coming in. And so if you're trying to maximize your training during a strength block and maximize your recovery, you want to be sure that you're at very least isocaloric at maintenance. And so overshooting that a little bit is probably okay. Just keep an eye on your weight. Obviously, you don't want it to be climbing a whole heap.
So during a hypertrophy phase, I like the numbers I use if I'm talking to clients about carbohydrate requirements are normally something in the realms of like 3 to 4 grams per kilo of carbohydrate as a like as a target low end intake, and then I say if you have more than that, that's fine. For a strength phase, how much of a reduction would you see in something like that?
To be honest, I think you can actually go pretty low and still be fine, but whether you want to risk it or not is really the issue. So like for me, I like to have plenty of padding there just as like a safety. Like you don't want to be going into a strength block and maybe your requirements are like, I don't know, like 180 grams of carbs a day to really maximize your performance. And it's like, you're on the borderline. You know what I mean? I'd rather just go, well, fuck, just eat like 250 or 300 grams of carbs and you don't even have to worry about it. I think the numbers that you threw out there are probably pretty good. I'd probably stick with that. Like I'm a fairly big proponent, and I think it comes from anecdotal experience, in that I don't need a lot of fat in my diet to feel good, and I prefer having more carbohydrates. So even as a bodybuilder doing training that probably mirrors hypertrophy or strength phases for powerlifting, I can even go as low as 0.5 grams per kilo of body weight in fat, which I'm between like 95 and 100 kilos most of the time. So that means I'm as low as maybe 50 grams of fat a day, and I feel fine on that personally. It's going to obviously be different for different people, you know, but I would say most people are probably going to be somewhere around like anywhere between 60 and 100 grams of fat a day, and then the rest of their calories are going to come from after you've sorted out your protein, are going to come from carbohydrate, and probably just leave it at that, and it should be sweet, but you know.
So how much do your energy requirements then actually fall between, you know, say you're going from a 5-day hypertrophy training split where you're doing, you know, 20-ish sets per session down to a strength phase where you might be training 4 or 5 days, but you've gone from doing, you know, 4 or 5 sets of 8 to, you know, 3 to 5 sets of 3 to 5. How much of a reduction in energy requirement is there in those phases?
Well, you would think it's quite a lot because the amount of volume you're doing or the amount of reps you're doing or whatever is a lot lower. But to be perfectly honest, you don't burn that much energy when you train. I think people overestimate how much energy you burn when you're actually training. The biggest factor in energy is your level of non-training activity during the day, so NEAT. and so, yeah, you will see a reduction in your total energy expenditure for sure, but it's not going to be on the order of like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calories. Like it's not going to be so much that you're going to need to make really drastic changes. It might be like per day, it might be like 100 or 200 calories at most, I would have thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then most of your energy expenditure is really going to come from just your daily activity and how big you are, you know.
All right. So from a big picture perspective, then we've gone from saying hypertrophy phases are good for putting on weight. You know, small to moderate surplus, so 100 to 300 calorie surplus,
mm-hmm.
relatively high carbohydrate intake. A strength phase, your carbohydrate requirements have fallen a little bit and your energy requirements have fallen a little bit, but neither by an enormous amount. So where does the energy reduction best come from? Is it from reducing carbs and fats together, fats or carbs?
I think it can be personal preference, to be perfectly honest. I don't think it'll make that much difference. I tend to, in my setups, I tend to have fat and protein is reasonably set in stone, and then I just manipulate carbohydrate just to make it easy. But like you might, you know, you got the flexibility of it. I think like a big factor that people don't really realize is that we do this sport for enjoyment, and like, yeah, we want to perform, but we also want to be able to actually stick to what we're doing and get a result at the end of the day. And if it means that like you're trying to, you know, like you just fucking hate buying low fat, like zero fat everything, and you can't fit in foods that you like in your diet, and it makes it harder for you to stick to it, then just have a little bit more fat and reduce your carbohydrate a little bit. It's not a huge deal. So adherence is really important and personal preference is important. And to be honest, when I get someone coming in, what I'll always do is ask their history. Like, what have you done before that worked really well? What have you done before that didn't really work that well? And a lot of times people will say, well, when I went low carb, like it didn't work that well for me, or it worked really well for me and I feel really good on that. And then I'll be like, all right, cool. So clearly this person might do a bit better on higher fat and lower carb for whatever reason. So maybe I'll just bias it a little bit more to that. And if we need to reduce energy, I might prefer to take it from the carbohydrate in that case. Most of the time it will be a case of like fat's going to be already reasonably low in my preferred diet setup. And so there's not a lot to take from that. So it's mostly going to come from carbohydrate.
And then what's sort of the best indication to you that your nutritional setup is correct?
Feeling energized, feeling recovered, exercise performance is good. I'm a big proponent of tracking, and obviously as powerlifters, one of the things that people do really well is they tend to track stuff really well. So you'll always have some kind of measure of performance in the gym, which is really handy. And that's something that bodybuilders fuck up completely, is that they don't actually track what they're doing. It's just like, oh yeah, that was a really hard workout, that was good.
Yeah, I'm sore.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, like that's something that people really screw up in bodybuilding, but powerlifting is great. So like if you can see that, your performance is dropping, and it's like something's not right, and there's a reasonable chance that nutrition might be a part of that. So it depends how you feel, depends how you perform, depends on how easy you're finding it to stick to your diet.
So it depends?
It depends, man.
Yeah. It's an absolute cop-out.
Yeah.
It's all right. Someday we'll get a guest on here that actually knows what they're talking about.
So let's move to peaking.
Yep.
So in peaking, our volume is going to be the lowest and our intensity is going to be the highest.
Yep.
What differs then in nutrition as we get closer and closer to the competition?
Yeah, so before I spoke a little bit about what factors are the most important, and like, you know, your base of the pyramid is your energy intake and your macronutrient ratios, and then like food timing and food quality starts to get more important the more advanced you are. And certainly I think as you go into a peaking phase, and even on the tail end of your strength phase, as you get closer to a comp, like those little things are going to make more difference. Like you're going to see the difference of that a lot more. So then, you know, if you're trying to optimize, you should be looking at things like nutrient timing, maybe some supplementation, things like that. And so I would be paying a lot more attention to how I time my meals. I would certainly around training, try and make them as, try and time that properly. Like if you're 12 weeks out or 16 weeks out from a comp and it's like you missed a meal, like it's not a huge deal. As you get closer, that might be all the difference in how you feel, how you recover, how you train. And so you have to really start paying attention to that stuff. It's also a case of like food quality, I think, starts to make a bit more of an impact, because if you're eating, enough vegetables, you're eating the right types of fats, things like that, overall you're going to feel better, which potentially means your performance is going to get better, your general outlook is going to be better. And I often like to say, like, a healthy athlete will be a good athlete. So you kind of look at those health sort of things as well. Whereas if you're just trying to get in calories and just bulk up and that sort of stuff, it's like, yeah, you need to pay attention to it, but it's not like as big a deal.
I feel like the closer that I get to a competition, every session feels more important.
Yep.
And it's not like it is, but it feels like it is.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
It feels like as you build momentum, you want to keep riding the momentum. And if you have a really good session, you might feel like you're doing better than you are.
Yes.
Even though you're just sort of continuing training like you would be.
Yep.
So those kind of feelings that training is good, especially the closer you get to competition, I think is really, really important.
Yeah, so, I think psychologically so valuable. And even I think this happens a lot where like it's sort of the naturalistic fallacy in a way. It's like if you're, let's say you're eating a lot of junk food and stuff and you're just getting the nutritional requirements that you need, a lot of people kind of just feel shitty on that because they're like, oh, I shouldn't be eating sugar or whatever. But, you know, if you had the same amount
it's
of glucose
you're,
hitting...
It's because you're missing like broccoli and...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Wake up every morning just so stoked to have another chance to eat broccoli today. You know? I think the poor kids in Africa never get their broccoli.
Yeah. Really missing their greens. But it's like... When you obviously if you're, you know, if you then get that same amount of carbohydrate, like from, you know, something a bit healthier like rice or something like that, then like you just tend to feel a bit better for probably psychological reasons more than anything. But it still helps, right? It still adds up.
Yeah. And I also find that the closer that I get to competition, the more excited I am to train.
Yeah.
So the more like planning I do with like,
yeah,
I'm going to eat this 2 hours before and then I'm going to do this and then whatever.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I think that's definitely true. And just to heap my anecdote on there as well, I found that sort of nutritional rituals, so I guess that is basically nutritional timing, do really help facilitate me training my best.
Mm.
And particularly when you're going into peaking, things like I always drink a sports drink before I train, not because I think sports drinks are magically useful. I think they're just about the right amount of carbohydrates and they sit in me well. But, you know, drinking my sports drink at the right time and having my caffeine at the right time makes a big difference when I'm handling like 90%. Whereas, you know, now if I'm sort of dicking around doing 8s to 12s, like I can just have some toast at the cafe, you know, an hour and a half out and I'm going to be fine.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing tying into food quality that I think is really interesting is I know that personally when I eat a like healthy diet, you know, with adequate vegetables and not too much sort of crap and salt and things, I tend to sleep better.
Mm.
And then I feel a heap better and train a heap better. And I'm wondering if you could shed any light on that or whether that sort of dovetails with your experience.
Yeah, I think it's probably true. I think there's probably a lot of things, like even if you find certain foods maybe mess with your digestion and stuff like that, like it's not comfortable to try and have, you know, 90% of your max on your back when you've got bloating and you're trying to brace really hard into a belt, for example. You know, the sleep thing's a really interesting thing as well. I think general feelings of joint discomfort and muscle soreness and stuff like that can probably be alleviated by eating a little healthier as well. Like, so I've had clients before where they are powerlifters and very, very strong powerlifters and very big powerlifters that need, you know, 6,000 calories a day to start moving up because they are 135 and need to be 145 for the future. Okay. So we're in a massive surplus. And the challenge there is like, how do you get in 6,000 calories a day
without feeling like shit
and without eating like too much junk food? And it's just little things. So I would tend to then bias, you know, the fat type that I use. Like we know that things like polyunsaturated fats tend to be a little bit healthier on the whole than saturated fats when consumed in larger quantities. And, you know, the little tweaks like that can help somebody to feel a lot better. And then I think it cascades into, okay, now I'm sleeping a little bit better. Now I feel a little bit more energetic during the day. Then my training session goes better than normal. You know, and then I'm on a psychological high because, man, I smashed my training today and I'm not feeling bloated all the time and all that sort of stuff. And it all just adds up.
Yeah, we spoke about that a little bit last week in the Q&A on nutrition on competition day and how to not eat foreign foods or not eat anything that you haven't eaten in a long time. And I think that is also very important all the time.
Yeah, massive. Yeah.
If you have an important session, don't, you know, eat something that's a little bit risky. Don't have 7-Eleven sushi.
Yeah. Maybe just don't ever do that.
No, it's the hot wings eating challenges that get you, you know, the night before your heaviest squats as you've gone and dropped 25 chili wings.
The 1 kilo burrito challenge.
Oh, God.
Mad Max.
All right. So what about in general, Luke? So I guess we've seen this this sort of pattern to nutrition where energy intake requirements are the highest and carbohydrate requirements are the highest during hypertrophy phases. During strength and peaking, energy and carbohydrate requirements fall a little bit, but it's still important to have enough to sustain training and give consideration to timing to the same end. What are the things, or are there any things that you think should be being done all the time that will support training adaptations or support recovery that you think people particularly don't do well?
Well, I think in general, probably, I'd see it, bodybuilders tend to be a little bit more neurotic about what they eat and they tend to be a bit more consistent with what they eat. I think as a power lifter, if you're someone who is meticulously tracking your training and is trying to get all of that stuff right, you should be paying at least as much attention to your nutrition as well and finding out what works for you, what sets you up for better training sessions, keeping some details on that and being more consistent with it. Like, I find it a bit frustrating when it's like people go into powerlifting and they're kind of like, well, it's just an excuse to kind of eat whatever the fuck I want. And, you know, it's just this weird culture around powerlifting, that thing's changing now for sure, but it used to just be a case of like, well, I just eat as much as I can and I lift as much as I can, and that's basically what powerlifting is.
I think a lot of that stems from what we used to see in the early days of powerlifting was all we would see is Westside.
Yeah, I think it comes from Westside.
We see these fucking huge guys lifting fucking huge weights.
The Waffle like, House pre-workout meal.
Yeah, and they talk about what exercise they're going to do that day because they don't have a plan.
Yeah.
Have you heard the Dave Tate bulking story? It's so funny. They're like, are you dedicated? Pizza? Yeah, the pizza that he would drench in olive oil that he would have to eat every day. And like, he's saying he'd sit there like staring it down, just dreading it.
Yeah, Don't be that guy. I think that's probably what powerlifters don't do well as a whole. Like, it's definitely a lot better. But from what I've seen with people coming to me, it's like, usually they're not as consistent as they could be. And they don't have like that. Like I said, bodybuilders have that hierarchy in their heads. They know that they need to have a certain amount of energy. They know what their macronutrient ratios are. And they know what foods work well from them. And they're pretty like consistent with it. Whereas I think powerlifters as a whole tend to be a lot less precise with that type of stuff, and I think that could be improved.
Yeah, a lot of that comes from like the whole IFYM thing.
Yeah,
it's like you're a bro if you eat chicken, rice, and broccoli. Well, like, no, not really. You're actually probably quite smart.
Yeah, no,
and
I agree.
Trying to fit in as many Twinkies and
Sour Patch Kids into your diet. You know, if you're going in and every time we know, like every time you squat, you want to be consistent. You want to drill in that technique. You want to dial it in. You want to give each rep as much focus as it deserves so that you can get better. It's like you should probably do that with most of your meals as well.
Yeah.
If you want to maximize your outcomes from training.
For sure. Yeah. One more thing. We could probably do a whole podcast on this as it is, but what about supplementation for powerlifters? What do you think? Do like a 1 minute take on what you think the powerlifters do wrong with supplements and what they could do well. Supplements.
Most supplements are bullshit. That's basically, that sums it up. Yeah. Now, like, okay, so the obvious stuff is like the stuff I would definitely be looking at if you're a powerlifter is caffeine and creatine. Those are probably the main things. Probably most of you are aware of it. Obviously, with creatine, be careful with your body weight. Some people actually don't experience much benefit from creatine, so it could be something that you could get away with not using at all.
But especially use lots of caffeine, because caffeine is great.
Yeah, but that's another thing. Like, you might want to even periodize your caffeine. Like, I personally couldn't do it because I can't live without it. So, like, forget it. Just forget it. Like, it's not an option. But some people are pretty happy to, like, not have caffeine for a while so that they can maximize the effectiveness in their peaking block and then for competition, for example. You know, other stuff, like there's not really a whole lot of other stuff that I really like. The only other stuff that I would think you might want to consider is stuff like vitamin D, if you're not really getting enough of that, and you can have a blood test to test that, or some fish oil. Like, so I mentioned unsaturated fats, polyunsaturated fats before. So the omega-3s from fish oil can be really helpful just from a general health perspective and like how your joints feel, an inflammatory sort of perspective. But that's only if you're not getting enough from your diet. So if you never eat fatty fish at all, like I don't really eat a lot of it, so I tend to supplement with a bit of fish oil. It's even been shown to support muscle growth, actually, recently. So that's something that I would consider.
Just taking you back to caffeine, I know that you sort of keep an eye on your maximum caffeine dosage. Hayes is going to hate this. do you,
1 gram what,
yeah,
every day.
What, yeah, 1 gram an hour. No, what do you think? What do you think people should consider as like a maximum caffeine dose? Also just to facilitate things like sleeping well, because I think that's very important.
Yeah. caffeine metabolism and how sensitive you are to it is very, very variable between individuals. So I'll give you an example. My wife can maybe handle one cup of coffee a day.
Shout out Funny.
Yep. Whereas I personally drink like usually about 4 cups a day, and that's totally cool. But I have a really hard cutoff of midday. Like, I go to bed at 8 p.m. and I wake up at 4:30 a.m. So, you know, yeah, just make fun of me now if you want. Go for it.
Luke's literally never watched Love Island because he just sleeps too early.
I can't.
It's the only thing stopping him.
Yeah, I wish, yeah.
Yeah, how's it on record?
Well, yeah. But then the cutoff for me is definitely midday for caffeine, so I have like a good 8 hours for it to sort of clear so it doesn't disturb my sleep. I think that's massive. Like, a lot of people sort of go, oh no, it doesn't really affect me. And it's like, well, it does. Like, it, you're not some physiological snowflake where it doesn't affect you. Like, it does affect you. So you've got to be careful of that. But it's down to individual tolerance. Like, some people can get away with a lot more than others. I would say, like, keep it as far away from your bedtime as you possibly can, just so you can maximize sleep, because sleep is highly underrated.
Unless it's competition day, in which case do all the caffeine.
Yeah, do as much as you
can. Don't worry
about
sleeping.
Nah, forget it.
All right, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back for some case study stuff.
Weekly Weights. Okay, welcome back to Weekly Weights. I'm Will. With me is Alex, and with us is Luke. We've just been doing like the equivalent of the Weet-Bix how many do you do discussion, talking about caffeine pills.
I win.
Yeah, Alex wins with like 27. He's got
the Brett Lee of caffeine.
Yeah, he's the Brett Lee of caffeine. Comes steaming in from miles out, just throwing caffeine pills down. Takes a 25-meter run up to his last deadlift, just chewing down no-nos.
I actually bring caffeine pills to comps and give them to my clients when they're lifting.
He does. He's walking around. He's like handing out lollies as though it's bloody Halloween.
I'm like, take three, don't ask questions.
Yeah, and then he slaps them all around the head and sends them out as well. It's so good.
And they all make the lifts.
All right. So what we want to do now is actually bring those concepts together and talk about how we would structure both training and nutrition. So considering both ends of the both ends to help an athlete move up a weight class, and then we'll do one to move down as well. So let's imagine we've got an 83 kilo powerlifter with reasonably good body composition, and we're looking to move them up to the 93 kilo division. So I guess, Luke, let's start from a really zoomed out view. What would you think about from a training and nutrition standpoint to help facilitate that change?
First thing is just to look at how much time they've got, because to go from 83 to 93 is like quite a big jump, and obviously you don't want too much fat there.
Probably like a lifetime.
Yeah, yeah, let's say this is a long-term project, because yeah, developmentally they just need to be up.
Yeah, for sure. Like, and it could be a case of like, maybe, you know, you could do meets in the meantime and just not worry about the weight class, you know what I mean, obviously. Basically, I would be looking at maximizing some of that higher volume training that we spoke about, so the hypertrophy stuff. You don't want to get away from strength phases too much, so you could even just alternate them more or less, because we know you can still gain a reasonable amount of muscle, or at least maintain it from a strength phase. And supporting that nutritionally, what I'd probably look at is a stepwise approach, and this will go if you're making a really big cut as well. I like using, and we haven't really spoken too much about this, which is actually quite a big part of diet periodization, is something like diet breaks or things of that nature. So the idea is that, let's say you've got a reasonably long time, like maybe 16 weeks or 20 weeks or something, that you want to make a big change to your body composition. What you can do is have either a pre-planned, or just kind of keep it in your back pocket type of thing to use it when you need it, couple of weeks break from the diet, where you either just go to maintenance or you sort of try and cut back a little bit of body fat along the way. So in the case of somebody trying to gain weight, what we do is, obviously, we know that as they're gaining some muscle, they're going to put on some fat as well. So up to a point where they're starting to kind of put on too much body fat, we might decide, okay, at this point, let's try and maintain the muscle mass that we've built so far, and we'll strip back some of the body fat. That's often referred to as a mini cut. And a mini cut might be like just a little dieting phase that's maybe sort of 4 to 6 weeks in length, just to bring back down some body fat before you start ascending again and bring the calories up to keep gaining muscle. And that way you can keep your body fat in check and still build muscle over a long period of time. And that's usually what a bodybuilder would probably do over a longer period of time when they're trying to put on size.
So if we use this 83 kilo lifter as an example, how much time would we want to spend in a hypertrophy block versus a strength block? Mm. And how much time would we want to spend in a surplus versus doing a mini cut or out of maintenance phase?
Yeah, from a training perspective, I'm sure you guys have some good insight on this, but I would tend to run maybe like two training cycles of hypertrophy to one of strength, something like that, I think would probably be fair.
So what cycle being 4 weeks or?
Yeah, for me, it's anywhere between 4 and 6 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. What do you guys normally do?
So that actually, we covered this in brief in the Q&A, and that actually exactly mirrors what Alex and I said.
Oh, cool.
So we were saying a reasonable structure would be to do something between, you know, like 4 and 8 weeks or 6 and 12 weeks of hypertrophy work, then a 4 to 6 week strength phase, and then either straight back to hypertrophy or into a very short peak if your goal is actually moving up the weight class. And for us, we were saying aiming for a reasonable rate of weight gain, so like 0.5% to 1% of your body weight per, did I say week or month? It must be per.
I personally think I used to consider like, you know, like a 0.5% increase in body weight per week, but I actually think that's probably a bit too high for a lot of people. So I would go on the lower end of that. If you're saying increasing like 1% a month, I reckon that's probably pretty good.
1 to 1.5% a month.
And then, but then we were saying, strength phase might be at maintenance or with like a very small rate of weight gain. We didn't actually speak specifically about mini cuts. I said I thought maintenance phases were really useful. How would you structure a mini cut? So if you're doing 6 weeks, is it meant to be very aggressive or is it just a very gradual thing?
You can go either way, because I actually, the way I personally do it is I don't really have the patience to diet for a long period of time because I like food too much. So what I do is I basically go with a 50% deficit for like 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
50%?
And I just fucking go for it. And I'm a hell to be around and it fucking sucks. But I know that it's only going to last like 3 or 4 weeks and I'm going to lose a lot of body fat in that process. So the key there is, like we spoke about before, to maintain your muscle mass now, adequate protein, and ensuring that you're still training really hard, because that's really what's going to keep the muscle mass on. Given that, like, you can, if you're going to lose muscle mass, I think it has to be a combination of two things. It has to be the degree to which you're in a deficit. So obviously a more extreme deficit, you run greater risk of losing muscle, but it's also a function of time. So if we're going a really extreme deficit for a short amount of time, I think it's really unlikely that you're going to lose any muscle mass if you're still training hard. And so you could do that. I think it kind of depends on your temperament and how good you are at dieting, for example.
So how would you structure your training and diet to mitigate the drawbacks of like a 50% deficit? Because how do you get adequate, say, carbs for training? In that instance.
Well, it's just hard, and you've got to position your carbs, the carbs that you do have, around your training. And I think it's just like a case of mental fortitude, doing as well as you can do with what you got. Again, in that sort of thing, that sort of setup, like the nutrient timing and trying to maximize other recovery modalities like sleep and general stress management is going to be really important. But you know, you could do that, or it really depends how much body fat you have to lose as well. Like, hopefully what's happened is you've put on mostly muscle and not that much body fat during your gaining phase, and then you just need to do like a regular sort of diet during your 4 weeks of like whatever, you know, maybe a 20% deficit or something like that, for however long you want to do it, maybe like 3 or 4 weeks or maybe up to 6 weeks, and then just pretty much go straight back into a gaining phase after that.
So we've gone a little bit off topic. Let's get back onto topic of moving up from 83 to 93.
Sorry, Alex, the disciplinarian.
Yeah, for once.
Usually this is not my role and I feel weird.
Yeah, normally Alex is the one just rudely calling out people. We haven't had a little podcast.
That'll come, don't worry.
I was just trying to think of someone to say and I couldn't think of anyone.
Give it time. By the end of the podcast, we'll have a new controversy for you.
So we spoke about spending a lot of time in a hypertrophy phase and then using strength phases to make sure we don't get out of touch with our heavy work. If we weren't looking at doing competition, let's say we had like 6 months of no competition, would you coincide the hypertrophy blocks with a higher volume of food, and then would you use the strength blocks as maintenance or cutting? How would you...
I think that's probably wise, like the way you said it, is to definitely during the hypertrophy phase, that's where you're going to be building the most muscle. You need to support that. Like, so you need to have the enough carbohydrate, enough energy, enough protein, for sure. Then the strength phase can either be your maintenance or it can be where you do your cut, because like Will said before, as long as the volume is sufficient, it doesn't need to be that much. Obviously, the weight's heavy enough, you're going to maintain your muscle mass during that phase. So that could be where you put your cut.
And like you just said just then, even if you go in a huge deficit, if you're training hard enough, you can keep the muscle on.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. So that's probably how I would set it up for sure. And then it's just a case of repeating that until you've basically gained enough, and then looking to compete, I suppose.
So what kind of time frame would you be looking from someone in this instance with good body composition at 83 to then be good body composition at 93? How long do you think that would take?
There's a really massive individual response to weight training. There's a study that I posted up on some of my social media recently that showed that some people had three times the average response to a weight training program in terms of muscle growth. Some people over this 12-week period, they basically did unilateral exercises, and some people didn't have that great a response over 12 weeks. Then there was the average response, and then there were a few people who did like three times as well as the average in terms of gaining muscle. So, you know, if you're a freak,
let's just say
good luck.
Let's say Larry Wheels.
Yeah. Larry Wheels.
Yeah, let's say you're a normie though. You're just a normie.
You're
person.
A normie.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just average genetics like Will.
Yeah, you're a schmuck, so you're designed to do a podcast instead of actually focus on being an athlete.
To gain 10 kilos of really high quality muscle, that could, like you guys said before, that could be a lifetime project for some people.
What's low quality muscle? Is that like flank steak as opposed to a Scotch?
Yeah, it's usually, yeah, exactly. No, you're exactly right. Yeah,
chuck.
Mostly, it's like when you know how nobody really likes eating the liver and the offal and stuff? It's like sometimes you'll grow an extra kidney and it's not really that helpful because you can exist with one kidney if you really needed to.
Great for drinking though. That's probably an indication you shouldn't be a powerlifter. Go drink.
Probably not.
So I wanted to ask you two, both of you. So there are kind of two options for how you could go about filling out a weight class. The first would be to, in this instance, literally try to get to 93 kilos, you know, more or less in a straight line.
Mm.
And that might still take a couple of years if you do it, you know, with relatively lean gains. And then the alternative would be to really sort of smell the roses on the way and try and stay quite lean and fill out much more gradually. What are the benefits and drawbacks to either of them that you can see?
Well, the thing is that if you're trying to go slow and smell the roses along the way, like that, like I said, that's going to be a pretty long thing for most people. So it's just whether you've got the patience for it, whether you enjoy it, whether you're going to stick to the sport. To be honest, I think that's a really big factor. If you don't really care either way and you're not like super competitive, then that's fine. It could just suit your personality. I think, like, you know, we've basically said, obviously you want to try and gain as much muscle as you can and limit the fat, but you might still lift more weight with a bit more fat on you at, like, you know, 93 kilos and maybe, yeah, you've put on a bit of muscle and a lot of fat, but like you could still be lifting a lot more and you might enjoy that. Like, that's fine. So
Luke's looking at me as if he wants me to go up to 90. Like, you would lift more at 90.
Yeah, you would lift more. So I think that's a consideration. Like, it might be a case of like, you're okay with putting on a bit of body fat and filling out the 93 class. And then, you know, you're lifting more and it's happy days. And then you can just spend your time in between, competitions, just trying to recomp a little bit, like cut a little bit of fat, build a little bit of muscle, and just kind of, you know, slowly but surely get better, even though you're weighing roughly 93 the whole time.
I think something to consider is how difficult it is to build muscle versus how easy it is to lose fat.
Yeah.
So I think what you've spoken about before is, like, it is quite easy to lose body fat. So I think it's all right to spend a vast majority of your time in a surplus and get
sure.
a tiny little bit fluffy and then pull it back a little bit
yep.
and then get a tiny little bit fluffy again and then pull it back a bit. And then eventually you'll be slightly less fluffy when you're fluffy.
No, I agree. I think, like, that's, you know, just to draw parallels to bodybuilding again, that's like people are terrified of losing their abs when they're a bodybuilder. But the reality is, if you want to get truly big, at some point you have to do that. Like,
I've got
it's
a
just
tip for everyone. Never get them in the first place.
Yeah, just go the keg. That's probably the easiest way, to be honest. So, like, yeah, definitely. Like, and once you've been through a successful diet and you kind of know what to expect and you know what works for you, like I described before, what works well for me, you know, I'm not stressed about putting on body fat anymore because I'm like, it'll take me 3 or 4 weeks and then I'll be lean again. It's fine. It's not a big issue. So, yeah, for sure.
Like, cutting sucks, but it's also kind of fun to actually see, like, drastic changes in your body on a short-term scale, whereas, like, trying to put on muscle or get bigger or even get stronger once you're half good, it takes so long.
It's actually kind of exciting as well.
Yeah,
like,
no, I agree,
if you've been in a surplus for 4 months or five months or something,
so over it.
You get over it, and then you're like, cool, let's like see what we can do in 6 weeks.
Mm.
Yeah,
and then you keep it to 6 weeks, and then you go straight back to it.
What's not exciting though is waking up in the morning and being like, I'm going to eat rice cakes today, and that's about it.
Until you get to the point where it's like you're that fucking hungry that rice cakes and broccoli really appeals to you and you're just happy having more of that. It's like, that's
can't
when
wait.
You know.
Yeah, when you're like worshipping the McCain's bag in your freezer.
when I used to do big cuts and I had very little calories when I was competing in 74s, I used to, if I was hungry, just go to sleep. 100%. I'd just have a nap and I'd be like, cool, I can't eat while I'm sleeping.
My biggest thing is... but my sleep gets a little bit disturbed when I'm hungry, but yeah. Like I just eat, I drink tons of tea, so then like yeah. I need to piss a lot as well, and then I can't sleep because I need to piss all the time as well. So it's a good situation.
Yeah, I used to do the same when I was trying to stay lean. Yeah, drink heaps of tea, and yeah, I'd go to bed at night and I'd be up 3 or 4 times a night just to pee.
You guys ever eaten just like pure psyllium husk and just washed it down with water when you're dieting?
Yeah, I reckon I've gone like 30 or 40 grams of oats to like 20 grams of psyllium husk on stage, and it was literally just like eating glue, which I also used to do.
Not as long ago as you would think.
Yeah, it was actually last week. So I guess to sum up what we were saying though about the sort of rates at which you fill out a weight class, my opinion is sort of that doing strategies to maximize short-term competitiveness can be good if you're actually a competitive person. Like if you really want to be a good powerlifter, then yeah, sweet, fill out the 93s so that you can actually have a good run at it. But yeah, if you're in it for a hobby, and particularly if you do, and most people do have like at least a degree of vanity, then it's not necessarily a bad thing to, you know, say going from 83 to 93 to spend a bit of time at like, you know, 87, 88, 90 kilos on the way up, provided that you're actually progressing your training. But I think it's also important to consider that at some stage, it might be hard to get stronger at that weight, in which case you got to bite the bullet and say, like, putting on weight's actually going to facilitate me getting better at this. Yeah. And if your hobby's powerlifting and not bodybuilding, then you got to do what you got to do to actually be a better lifter, I guess. And nutrition's just another tool we have to help along that track.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that for sure.
Okay, why don't we do the reverse now? So let's think about an athlete trying to move down a weight class. So we can start with the same example. Maybe a 93 kilo lifter or somebody who's maybe like 95 kilos, but they're a bit of a fluff ball and long term they should be an 83. How can we manipulate training and diet phases to actually help with that change and also help them develop as a lifter?
Honestly, I think I would probably go a really similar setup, and I would just ensure that in terms of training, and then I would probably just make sure that the deficit is appropriate for something that they can sustain. I would probably have some diet breaks along the way to give them an opportunity to have a bit of a mental refresh and also spend a bit of time actually seeing what they're capable of with their training. So for example, what you could do is go, right, I'm gonna spend 6 months dieting. And so I might diet for the first 2 months. Let's say you got like maybe 8 to 10 weeks of dieting. Then I might have a phase which coincides with a strength training phase, for example, of, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of, say, a strength phase.
Where you kind of like test the waters with the new leverages.
Test the waters with the new leverages, see where you're at, see what your strength's like. You spend a bit of time getting used to that. You get a bit more calories to play with as well. So what I would do there in the diet break, just to clarify, I would try and bring the calories back up to what your new maintenance is. So over that sort of 8 weeks of dieting, you might have lost, say, 4 kilos of body fat, something like that. And so I would just recalculate what your maintenance is, try and go to that, try not to lose weight, try not to gain weight when you go to your diet break, and then spend 4 to 6 weeks at that rough maintenance level. Maybe do your strength phase there, and then you can sort of take another run at dropping down another 3 to 4 kilos again, and just repeat that until you've hit roughly the target that you want to do. And then kind of go from there in terms of trying to build your strength up again.
Let's say you did have 6 months, like you said. Do you think it would be a good idea to compete at any point before the end of competition? So like, let's say the lifter was 80 kilos trying to get to the 74s.
Mm-hmm.
Would you maybe compete halfway in the 6 months? So 3 months in, maybe at 77?
Hmm.
Would you think that would be a good idea?
You could do that. I think... like, you know, we've always got to be cognizant of trying to maintain the skill aspect of the training. And like we said before, you know, just feeling out the leverages and stuff like that. You could definitely do that, but I wouldn't necessarily be trying to break any records or anything at that point. It would be more a case of like just staying in the sport, keeping your mind in the game, feeling what your leverages are like, comparing your strength, things like that. I think that's a viable strategy. but it's also going to be a case of like during that time, you're probably not going to want to be in a deficit during your peaking phase and all that type of stuff. So it's probably prolonging your diet at that point. Like if it's going to take you 6 months to get lean, but you want to do a comp in the middle of it, probably add another, you know, 3 to 4 weeks in the middle so that you can do the comp to your dieting phase.
What about, so you sort of spoke about the importance of your carbohydrate timing and things for like facilitating training when you're in your short-term heavy deficits. For a long-term one, how important is that? And would you have your diet break sort of set in stone in advance? Like, would you say I'm going to run out this 8 weeks? Or do you ever just say, hey, you know, you're looking pretty run down, let's start the diet break early?
Yeah, I usually what I do is I have a rough idea, just to answer the second part, I have a rough idea of when we might want to put in a diet break. Because you don't want to just, like, some people aren't super disciplined with them and they're like, oh yeah, you know, I've been dieting really hard now, it's been 3 weeks, and they're like, oh, let's do a diet break. You don't need a diet break at that point. You can definitely have it as something that you keep as a tool, and then it's like, you know, you might have a week where other stressors become really high. Like maybe you have just a bad week at work, you've got like, you know, uni exams on, something shitty happens at your job, like whatever it is. And then you can go, right, I've had this diet break in my back pocket, I'm going to pull it out and use it now because I'm just feeling super run down, super stressed in other parts of my life and I need my recovery to be better. That's certainly something you can do. So I tend to pre-plan it and go, right, let's do at least 6 weeks of dieting, probably closer to 8 to 10 weeks, and then plan for, you know, 2 or 3, maybe 4 weeks of a diet break at least. But then it's a shifting target too. With the carbohydrate question, I do think that like the timing and all that sort of stuff is not nearly as important as the amount of calories you get in and the macronutrient ratios, and probably even over a longer period of time, food quality. However, I do think that if you're looking to accrue, I suppose, sort of a compound interest effect in terms of maximizing your performance over multiple months and years, then probably paying attention to that stuff at some point is important. And the more advanced you get, the more important it's going to be. So if you're really looking to go as far as you can in the sport, I would start thinking about it. If you're doing it for fun, it's probably not as important.
So this occurs to me, we haven't asked about this, but during both gaining and cutting phases, how much value do you think there is to actually manipulating the amount of energy and carbohydrate you get on a day-by-day basis? So in like a training versus an off day?
I don't use that stuff too much. Like carbohydrate cycling stuff, I don't really use too much personally. Because I tend to think that I would prefer to be as consistent as I can rather than having stuff jump all around. But it depends on the psychology of the lifter. Some people prefer to be like, okay, I can work really hard because I know that, you know, the day before my leg day, I'm going to get a lot more carbohydrate, and like it just keeps them engaged better. And to add to that point, if you're in a deficit and you're looking to replenish your glycogen stores and stuff, I probably wouldn't put the carbohydrates on the big training day. I would put them the day before the big training day so that you've actually replenished the glycogen and you're ready to go for the big training day, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
For me, I like to use higher carbohydrate day on a training day just to get more food and feel better on the actual day itself. Not for any performance benefit, but just actually feeling better.
Yeah, and I mean, again, that it could depend on your training as well. Like, you know, if you're training, if you're training in the afternoon, then eating carbohydrate throughout the day, that's probably fine. Personally, I train in the mornings usually, so like, I would need to be eating that at least at my dinner, probably those carbohydrates, so I can use them in my training session. But I think that psychological boost that you get from having more carbohydrate is really useful for a lot of people. For other people, it kind of fucks their rhythm up and they kind of need the consistency of having like the same thing every day. I'm a bit more like that. I don't really like eating different stuff on different days. I just want to have my numbers in front of me and hit them every day.
Yeah, okay.
So something that I've done myself and with a couple of athletes is to sort of give a bit of a calorie window. So you might say like, you know, say you're gaining weight on 3,000 calories or something. I might say, look, your target calories are, you know, anywhere between 2850 and 3150 I'd consider acceptable. And then I would let them sort of use hunger and the demands of that day as a bit of a guide. And I guess that leads to some inadvertent calorie cycling, because for me, often the days that I'm hungriest are the days when, like, you know, I work for a long time, which for me is like 3 to 4 hours. And then, and then train. And then, you know, do something else in the afternoon or whatever. Whereas there's some days, like the odd Sunday, I might wake up and do nearly nothing, like walk my dog. And then otherwise, I'm literally, you know, chilling out all day. And on those days, my appetite's lower as well. So I think that can be a sort of viable strategy to preserve some flexibility. And then when you go into a dieting phase, you can maybe make those swings just a tiny bit more concrete, but do it in a way where you're sort of, you're guided by what the patterns of hunger and energy have been like beforehand.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the biggest breakthroughs I have had with a lot of clients is having them look at their calorie intake on a weekly basis rather than a daily basis, because that also gives you flexibility. If you're doing a 6-month cut or whatever, there's going to be situations there where you're going to have social events, you're going to have normal life. And like, let's be honest, we're all doing this as a hobby. It's not like you're a pro athlete when you're doing this. So you need to have...
Hey, don't say that.
Not yet, anyway. So you need to have that flexibility built in there. And so having that concept of like a floating calorie target or like a weekly target where you can sort of, change what you're eating on what day. Like, I know I'm going out for a mate's birthday on Saturday night, so I'm going to ensure that like for this whole week, maybe I'm eating a little bit less so that I have enough calories to enjoy myself on Saturday night sort of thing. That can work just fine.
Right. And is there anything... just sort of psychologically used to draw the line between like actually using that as a tool for flexibility as opposed to sort of compensatory like binging and restriction?
Yeah, that's, that's where it comes into the personality type of the person in front of you. Like, I've said it many times throughout this podcast, but certain things psychologically seem to work better for certain people. And so there is some flexibility that's built into your diet setup. I think the concept that you brought up of having a range is probably one of those things that's really helpful. So people don't beat themselves up if they go a little bit over. And at the same time, they're not having this massive swing reaction from eating too much where they like won't eat anything the next day because it's like, oh fuck, I had a burger yesterday and now I've got to compensate for it by eating like nothing the next day, for example.
I think one of the most useful sort of ways of appraising how you eat that I've discovered, again, both with myself and with clients, is to consider what your training is doing for your performance. And this is one of the reasons I think powerlifting might be slightly mentally healthier than bodybuilding for many people, is that it's easy to sort of reconcile having a bad day's eating or something with powerlifting if you sort of wake up the next day and you have a sick session, because your outcome measure is like how well you've lifted weights. Whereas I think bodybuilders, and often this is misguided, can be like, oh crap, like, you know, I overate, and it's almost inconsequential to them that the next day they had like their best ever chest session because they're still beating themselves up about the fact that they might have put on like 10 grams of fat that wasn't on their body before. Whereas really, if you look at things, and this is probably the crux of this whole podcast, if you look at things through the prism of saying like, am I eating in a way that's actually facilitating my training performance and treating yourself like an athlete, then you get better training outcomes or better training performance, which long term is better physical and physiological outcomes.
And actually it's really interesting that you bring that up, because that's how I've moved with bodybuilding training now, is it's performance based. And that's something that, like, why I say I don't consider powerlifting training and bodybuilding training very different at all, because the way I set up bodybuilding is that there is a performance goal that you're trying to achieve. And I've changed that mindset. There's been a lot of females that have come to me who are now, we have a big focus on getting their squat up, getting them stronger, that type of thing. Whereas before, they're doing so much fucking metabolic work and just stressing over like, I didn't feel tired enough at the end of my session. I ate too much and now I have to do heaps of extra training. And it's like, they're not been measuring their performance. They've not been focused on their performance. They've not really focused too much on progressive overload, things like that, which is really the crux of powerlifting. And so by instituting that in bodybuilding, it's taken them off that kind of mindset that you just described, and they're actually getting better results for it, for sure.
I've done a few bodybuilding preps for clients, and I always program from the prism of being a powerlifter.
Yep.
So for me, like, getting stronger for as long as you can during a bodybuilding prep is obviously a good idea.
Yep.
And all the guys who I've prepped looked great and they held on to a lot of muscle when they got to their show. And I think that's probably the biggest reason for that. I think that's, super important.
Yeah. And I think, this is a whole other kettle of fish, and Luke, I'd love to have you on again to talk about this. But that sort of concept in training of thinking like, you know, I actually have to get better at the things that I'm doing in the gym to feel like I'm getting better, is like one of the biggest favors you can do yourself when training for bodybuilding. And I think a lot of bodybuilders get caught up in this idea of do more work, like get a sick pump, get sore, you know, like do more sets than I did last week. But unless there's like you know, over time and actual improvement in your performance in those, you know, whether it's multiple sets of bench press or whatever it happens to be, unless there's actually an improvement in that over time, then something about your training or nutrition strategy is shit, because you're not actually getting an outcome from your training. You're just going in there and sort of burning some energy and, you know, getting a pump in your stringer.
And also on that, it's a very good idea to plan easier and harder weeks as a bodybuilder as well, like it is with a powerlifter. A lot of bodybuilders will go in and they'll go, chest today, smash it, get a pump. And they'll do that for 4 weeks and then they'll be cooked.
That was a massive learning curve for me. And I'm actually at the point now where I've recognized how much work I can handle and still improve. And it actually, to me, it's been really, really psychologically difficult, because in the past I've done so much more work in the gym.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's you feel like more is better. But more is not always better.
It's kind of fun sometimes to just go in there and be like, well, how many fucking walking lunges can I do until I fall over, sort of thing.
That's not fun.
Well, for me, that's fine.
On my right leg, it's one. Unfortunately, that's my problem. Yeah.
But I mean, I just accumulate stress so much, and I realized after a while, it's like, man, I pretty much use like the same weights on fucking everything all the time. And for me, I've actually realized that for me to improve my weights, the training volume has to be a lot lower than it was in the past. I have to track things a little bit better, I have to set everything up a little bit better, and I have to have those deloads. And even though psychologically it's very difficult, because it feels like I'm probably doing half of what I want to do in the gym, the outcome's been a lot better for me, for sure.
Okay, and just because this is getting accidentally profound, I'd love to bring it back to nutritional periodization. Now that you've realized that you need that sort of like that slightly lower volume but maybe slightly more pulsatile, I would say, like, you know, some like actually hard sessions and easy sessions and things, you still prefer to have a more consistent approach in the way in which you give yourself nutrition through the week?
I still do that, for sure. The reason being is that like I said, I just prefer having the consistency, but also I think that on a long enough timeline, that evens out.
Right.
So it just averages out over a long enough timeline. And that goes back to what we were talking about before, about people like, you know, if you fuck up one day, it's like, you're not going to remember that day in 2 weeks' time. Yeah. You're not going to remember a bad week in 6 months' time.
I went to a party. It was the 21st birthday of a good friend of mine. And this bloke that I knew was there, and he had sort of started tracking his nutrition. And he'd been doing it for about 6 months, and he'd lost a lot of weight. He looked really good.
Mm.
And he bailed me up. And he started saying to me, what's the most calories you've ever eaten in a day? I said, oh, God,
Please shout him out.
I'm not going to shout his name out.
He definitely listens.
I'm not going to shout his name out. But yeah, he was asking me, how many calories have you eaten in a day? I said, I don't know. He goes, oh, man, this one time back in June, I had like 3,200 calories. and I was like, fucking hell, like, you need to settle down, because it's just not that important. Like, and this is, I guess, to bring this back on point, you know, the only reason that you track your nutrition and you plan your nutrition is to facilitate you actually getting better and making the gains you want to do. And so I guess what I'm hoping this episode will do is give people ideas of how to strategize, you know, to use their eating to get the outcomes that they want, rather than to have nutritional structure be an end in itself.
Yeah.
Because 100%. I think that's a slippery slope to like just neuroticism and disordered eating.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So I think that sums up what we've been talking about really well.
Cool. I will throw it to you though, just to sum up, what are the important things to consider in nutritional periodization? How can it help you? And any sort of parting thoughts before we give you the four questions that tell us everything we need to know about a person?
Okay, so if I were to summarize everything about nutritional periodization, is that we want to use nutrition to facilitate our training performance. We want to use it to facilitate our body composition. From there, it's basically a hierarchy where in the amount of energy you have coming in and the macronutrient ratios are the most important thing. You should always cover that stuff off first. Make sure you're really consistent with that. And then you can start to look to things like, nutrient timing, food quality, and supplements. After that, the more advanced you get, the more that's going to matter. But as a general rule, unless you've got the basic stuff in place and you're sticking to it, it's really not going to get you anywhere else. To try and chase the other stuff and be too neurotic about things.
And exogenous ketones.
Oh, fuck. Mate, please do not stop me on that fucking shit. All
Jesus. Right, quick break, four questions.
Welcome back to Weekly Weights. Will and I are here with Luke Tulloch. We're going to ask you the four questions that tell you everything you need to know about a person.
Mm.
But before we do that, Luke, you're always very mild-mannered.
Yeah.
And I want to rile you up a little bit.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Can you tell us one thing in the fitness industry that annoys you the most at the moment?
Ketones.
go into more detail.
Okay, so here's the thing: is the ketone? There's two things. There's the ketogenic diet.
Which, I want you to swear and get like all ranty.
Yeah, I did a podcast recently where it was like the theme was like get fucking ranty, and I was just like sputtering, and I couldn't quite like get over.
Which podcast was that?
Macabolic podcast.
Oh, okay. That's Mackenzie Baker.
He likes having a rant, and so he's trying to get me to rant as well, but I'm a little bit more like...
Loves topless photos while holding an like acai bowl or whatever. How do you pronounce that?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, me either. I've never eaten one.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that riles me up about the fitness industry.
acai
or whatever it is.
Superfoods, go.
Yeah, superfoods. Yeah.
You know, I reckon there's actually a strong correlation between foods you can't pronounce and then being healthy. Because when you think about it, you got like acai bowls, not to be confused with acai, the beer. You got quinoa.
Yeah, true.
Chia, other ones?
Yeah, that's right.
Spirulina and ginseng. That's two foods that come together, both of which I can't pronounce.
There's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. So yeah, if you can say it. Wasn't the real macaw? No, macaw is a type of bird. There's like macaw root or something.
Yeah.
Basically,
everything you would find at About Life.
Yeah, if it's at About, like I'm a dietitian, so you can take this one to the bank. If you can't pronounce the food, it's almost certainly magical.
Yeah.
But if you can't pronounce the chemical, it's almost certainly poisonous.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
too.
shout out dihydrogen monoxide. All right, Luke. Things that upset you.
Okay, so the ketone thing, there's two things. There's the actual ketogenic diet, which is like, it's fine, but I just don't understand why you would do it. There's some medical cases where like, yeah, okay, you got epilepsy, sure, give it a go. Otherwise, there's just no fucking point. Then there's exogenous ketones, and this is like where people are going, well, yeah, I know it's a multi-level marketing scheme, but I don't fucking care because the fucking thing works, mate. It's a joke. It's like, it just doesn't... the research is not there. It's all MLM bullshit. It's expensive. It tastes like shit. Why the fuck would you do it? And people are getting dragged into this stupid fucking supplement. And like every supplement that's come before it, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. And you shouldn't be focusing on fucking exogenous ketones.
Yeah, so I often say to people, like, if you have the money to waste on a shitty supplement and your diet's not perfect, then like you really need to get a hobby. Like a hobby outside of the gym.
It's ridiculous. Like... Yeah,
If you want to spend some money on supplements and get them to actually work, get some Tren.
Yeah, exactly. Get the special Russian supplements. Those ones.
All right.
Anyway, the first question: if you could take anyone out to dinner, dead or alive, who would it be and why?
Well, it's a tough question. So I'm going to make it topical because I've seen a interview with. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but like Lars Ulrich from the drummer from
Metallica
has been interviewing people for this like Apple Beats Music thing, which has been pretty interesting. And Billy Corgan's been on there. Billy Corgan's from the Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah, Smashing Pumpkins.
And he's a pretty interesting dude. He's a fucking weirdo, but he's a super interesting dude. And I actually have listened to a couple of podcasts with him lately where he's describing how crazy the music industry made him. Because if you don't know, like at one time he was probably like the Smashing Pumpkins were like the biggest thing probably in the world musically at one point. And he just described how much it fucked him up. And I just really like to hear more stories about it.
Yeah.
So probably him.
There you go.
Question two, who's your favorite athlete of all time?
Just as far as athletic ability, I'm not really sure, but I have to say that somebody that I really admire, if you don't know, I am really into rugby union, and so Richie McCaw is somebody that
off.
I really like.
Alright, we're terminating the podcast here. I thought you were going to say David Pocock, and I was fist pumping like...
McCaw, I gotta say I really... admire McCaw.
You admire how much he gets away with cheating.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about him.
Yeah, they made a special entry in every stadium he went to, so he could come in
like,
from the side.
He's like all those natty bodybuilders who aren't natty competing in natty federations. That's Richie McCaw.
Well, speaking of bodybuilders, the big Coleman's pretty, Ronnie up Coleman. There. Just can't even squat it so much. You can't even walk now. How good is that?
But, I'm so quotable. Yeah. No. Okay. Do have to give Richie McCord a shout out for being a good player, but also like enemy of the people. Luke, I'm so disappointed. Are you a New Zealander?
No, I'm not.
What's wrong with you? All right.
I just think he's a good player,
man. He's just a cunt. He's not a New Zealander.
All right, shout out Richie McCaw, you grub. All right.
If you're listening.
Yeah, it's so annoying because he's allegedly a really good bloke and it just makes it hard to hate him. All right, question three, you can redeem yourself, hopefully. Which character from a TV show or a movie are you most like?
Well, I got a little story about this because I got the... So I've got a beard and long hair and I look kind of Nordic, even though I'm not. I still ham it up, so that's all right. But... my wife and I went to this little town outside of Melbourne for a getaway, like last year or something, and it's right for around where the Hemsworth brothers are from.
Yeah.
So we go to this place where we're staying, and we go to the farm, and I think there's three of the brothers, and they're sort of like progressively less attractive. So, like Chris is like the most attractive, and then there's like another one, and then like Liam, and then there's one other guy, and he's like not really that attractive.
There's actually a fourth brother that went out of the basement.
Yeah, it's me. So I go up to the farm, and they're like, oh, you look a lot like the Hemsworth boys, actually. And I was like, oh yeah. And they're like, yeah, not Chris. I was like, oh, okay. They're like, yeah, not really Liam either, but the other one, yeah. I was like, oh yeah, well, I'll take it, I guess. So I guess with all that said.
So Quasimodo Hemsworth.
Yeah, Quasimodo. Not Thor, but Quasimodo.
All right. Okay, question number four. Your life is a montage. What's the soundtrack?
There's this metal band, and they're just named after the amplifiers that they use called Sun, and it's literally just droning. It's just...
So it's your Instagram stories, basically, the montage, yeah, just droning.
It is droning, yeah. So they'll have like a song that's like 10 minutes long and it's literally just them playing maybe one note every 20 seconds or so.
Is it like angry droning or like...
No, just regular droning. just stock standard droning.
As much emotion as you can impart in a drone.
I take a lot of inspiration out of it, to be honest. You might have noticed that during the podcast.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. So I'm Will Berkman on Instagram. You can find me at w.berkmanp2,
and you can find me at alexhayes_lift. Luke, where can they find you?
Lucid Health Coaching is my company, so if you go Luke Lucid Health on Instagram, I post like some study summaries and I drone on there as well.
Okay, and one final thing that we want to get you to do is read one of our fans' reviews out.
Okay.
So, let's get you one. Okay, you can go with this one by Lady Como.
Lady Como says, unexpectedly good. I've always considered Will a pretty disappointing son. So I was pleasantly surprised to discover that this podcast was quite good. I think Will has found his perfect medium because he really has a face for radio. Ha ha ha. Probably got that from Dad.
Love.
That was me. Then there's more. Regards, Mum. Also, if you read this, please take out the recycling.
All right.
Scumbag.
Yeah, thanks, Mum. All right. Catch you guys next week.